They passed through one village after another, each one a cluster of dilapidated huts huddled around a great white church, built squat and strong to survive earthquakes. They zigzag around heaps of fresh coconuts piled by the roadside, spilling out into the right-of-way. Finally, they turn off the main road and into a dirt track that winds through the trees. The track has been rutted by the tires of trucks that are much too big for it. Freshly snapped off tree branches litter the ground. They pass through a deserted village. Stray dogs flit in and out of huts whose front doors swing unlatched. Heaps of young green coconuts rot under snarls of black flies. Another mile down the road, the cultivated forest gives way to the wild kind, and a military checkpoint bars the road. The smile vanishes from the driver's face. Goto Dengo states his name to one of the guards. Not knowing why he is here, he can say nothing else. He is pretty sure now that this is a prison camp, and that he is about to become an inmate. As his eyes adjust, he can see a barrier of barbed wire strung from tree to tree, and a second barrier inside of that. Peering carefully into the undergrowth, he can make out where they dug bunkers and established pillboxes. He can map out their interlocking fields of fire in his mind. He sees ropes dangling from the tops of tall trees where snipers can tie themselves into the branches if need be. It has all been done according to doctrine, but it has a perfection that is never seen on a real battlefield, only in training camps. He is startled to realize that all of these fortifications are designed to keep people out, not keep them in. A call comes through on the field telephone. The barrier is raised, and they are waved through. Half a mile into the jungle, they come to a cluster of tents pitched on platforms made from the freshly hewn logs of the trees that were cut down to make this clearing. A lieutenant is standing in a shady patch, waiting for them.
Lieutenant Goto, I am Lieutenant Mori.
You have arrived in the Southern Resource Zone recently, Lieutenant Mori.
Yes, how did you know?
You are standing directly beneath a coconut tree.
Lieutenant Mori looks straight up in the air to see several woolly brown cannonballs dangling high over his head.
Ah, so, he says, and moves out of the way. Did you have any conversation with the driver on the way here?
Just a few words.
What did you discuss with him?
Cigarettes, silver.
Silver?
Lieutenant Mori is very interested in this, so Goto Dengo recounts their whole conversation.
You told him that you were a digger?
Something like that, yes.
Lieutenant Mori backs off a step, turning to an enlisted man who has been standing off to the side and nods. The enlisted man picks the butt of his rifle up off the ground, wheels the weapon around to a horizontal position, and turns towards the driver. He covers the distance in about 6 steps, accelerating to a full sprint, and cuts loose with a throaty roar as he drives his bayonet into the driver's slim body. The victim is picked up off his feet, then sprawls on his back with a low gasp. The soldier straddles him and thrusts the bayonet into his torso several more times, each stroke making a wet hissing sound as metal slides between walls of meat. The driver ends up sprawled motionless on the ground, jetting blood in all directions.
The indiscretion will not be held against you, says Lieutenant Mori brightly, because you did not know the nature of your new assignment.
Pardon me?
Digging. You are here to dig, Goto-san.
He snaps to attention and bows deeply.
Let me be the first to congratulate you. Your assignment is a very important one.
Goto Dengo returns the bow, not sure how deep to make it.
So I'm not...
He gropes for words. In trouble? A pariah? Condemned to death?
I'm not a low person here.
You are a very high person here, Goto-san. Please come with me.
Lieutenant Mori gestures towards one of the tents. As Goto Dengo walks away, he hears the young motorcycle driver mumble something.
What did he say?
Lieutenant Mori asks.
He said, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. It's a religious thing.
Goto Dango explains. California. Half of the people who work at SFO, San Francisco International Airport, now seem to be Filipino, which certainly helps to ease the shock of re-entry. Randy gets singled out, as he always does, for a thorough luggage search by the exclusively Anglo customs officials. Men traveling by themselves with practically no luggage seem to irritate the American authorities. It's not so much that they think you are a drug trafficker as that you fit, in the most schematic possible way, the profile of the most pathologically optimistic conceivable drug trafficker, and hence practically force them to investigate you. Irritated that you have forced their hand in this matter, they want to teach you a lesson. Travel with a wife and four kids next time, or check a few giant trundling bags or something, man. What were you thinking? Never mind that Randy is coming in from a place where death to drug traffickers is posted all over the airport, the way caution, wet floor, is here. The most Kafka-esque moment is, as always, when the customs official asks what he does for a living, and he has to devise an answer that will not sound like the frantic improvisations of a drug mule with a belly full of ominously swelling heroin-stuffed condoms. "I work for a private telecommunications provider." Seems to be innocuous enough.
"Oh, like a phone company," says the customs official, as if she's having none of it.
"The phone market isn't really that available to us," Randy says, "so we provide other communications services, mostly data."
"Does that involve a lot of traveling around from place to place, then?"
asks the customs official, paging through the luridly stamped back pages of Randy's passport. She makes eye contact with a more senior customs official who sidles over towards them. Randy now feels himself getting nervous, exactly the way your drug mule would, and fights the impulse to scrub his damp palms against his pant legs, which would probably guarantee him a trip through the magnetic tunnel of a CAT scanner, a triple dose of mint-flavored laxative, and several hours of straining over a stainless steel evidence bucket.
"Yes, it does," Randy says.
The senior customs official, trying to be unobtrusive and low-key in a way that makes Randy stifle a sort of gasping, pained outburst of laughter, begins to flip through some appalling communications industry magazine that Randy stuffed into his briefcase on his way out the door back in Manila. The word Internet appears at least 5 times on the front cover. Randy stares directly into the eyes of the female customs official and says, "The Internet." Totally factitious understanding dawns on the woman's face, and her eyes ping bosswards. The boss, still deeply absorbed in an article about the next generation of high-speed routers, shoves out his lower lip and nods, like every other 90s American male who senses that knowing this stuff is now as intrinsic to maleness as changing flat tires was to Dad.
"I hear that's really exciting now," the woman says in a completely different tone of voice,
and begins scooping Randy's stuff together into a big pile so that he can repack it. Suddenly, the spell is broken. Randy is a member in good standing of American society again, having cheerfully endured this process of being ritually goosed by the government. He feels a strong impulse to drive straight to the nearest gun store and spend about $10,000. Not that he wants to hurt anyone, it's just that any kind of government authority gives him the creeps now. He's probably been hanging out too much with the ridiculously heavily armed Tom Howard. First a hostility to rainforests, now a desire to own an automatic weapon. Where is this all going? Avi is waiting for him, a tall, pale figure standing at the velvet rope surrounded by hundreds of Filipinas in a state of emotional riot, brandishing gladiola spears like medieval pikemen. Avi has his hands in the pockets of his floor-skimming coat, and keeps his head turned in Randy's direction, but is sort of concentrating on a point about halfway between them, frowning in an owlish way. This is the same frown that Randy's grandmother used to wear when she was teasing apart a tangle of string from her junk drawer. Avi adopts it when he is doing basically the same thing to some new complex of information. He must have read Randy's email message about the gold. It occurs to Randy that he missed a great opportunity for a practical joke. He could have loaded up his bag with a couple of lead bricks and then handed it to Avi and completely blown his mind. Too late.
Avi rotates around his vertical axis as Randy comes abreast of him and then breaks into a stride that matches Randy's pace. There is some unarticulated protocol that dictates when Randy and Avi will shake hands, when they will hug, and when they will just act like they've only been separated for a few minutes. A recent exchange of email seems to constitute a virtual reunion that obviates any handshaking or hugging. "You were right about the cheesy dialogue," is the first thing Avi says. "You're spending too much time with Shafto, seeing things his way. This was not an attempt to send you a message, at least not in the way Shafto means."
"What's your interpretation, then?"
"How would you go about establishing a new currency?" Avi asks. Randy frequently overhears snatches of business-related conversation from people he passes in airports, and it's always about how did the big presentation go, or who's on the shortlist to replace the departing CFO, or something. He prides himself on what he believes to be the much higher plane, or at least the much more bizarre subject matter of his interchanges with Avi. They are walking together around the slow arc of SFO's inner ring. A whiff of soy sauce and ginger drifts out of a restaurant and fogs Randy's mind, making him unsure for a moment which hemisphere he's in.
It's not something I have given much thought to," he says.
"Is that what we are about now? Are we going to establish a new currency?"
"Well, obviously, someone needs to establish one that doesn't suck," Avi says.
"Is this some exercise in keeping a straight face?" Randy asks.
"Don't you ever read the newspapers?"
Avi grabs Randy by the elbow and drags him over towards a newsstand. Several papers are running front-page stories about crashing Southeast Asian currencies, but this isn't all that new.
"I know currency fluctuations are important to Epiphyte," Randy says.
"My God, it's so tedious, I just want to run away."
"Well, it's not tedious to her,"
Avi says, yanking out three different newspapers that have all decided to run the same wire service photograph, an adorable Thai moppet standing in a mile-long queue in front of a bank, holding up a single American dollar bill.
"I know it's a big deal for some of our customers," Randy says. "I just didn't really think of it as a business opportunity."
"No, think about it," Avi says.
He counts out a few dollar bills of his own to pay for the newspapers, then swerves towards an exit. They enter a tunnel that leads to a parking garage.
"The Sultan feels that you've been just sort of hanging out with the Sultan.
Mostly with Pragasu. Will you let me finish? We decided to set up the crypt, right?"
"Right."
"What is the crypt?"
"Do you remember its original stated function?"
"Secure, anonymous, unregulated data storage. A data haven."
"Yeah, a bit bucket. And we envisioned many applications for this."
"Boy, did we ever,"
Randy says, remembering many long nights around kitchen tables and hotel rooms, writing versions of the business plan that are now as ancient and as lost as the holographs of the four Gospels.
"One of these was electronic banking. Heck, we even predicted it might be one of the major applications, but whenever a business plan first makes contact with the actual market, the real world, suddenly all kinds of stuff becomes clear. You may have envisioned half a dozen potential markets for your product, but as soon as you open your doors, one just explodes from the pack and becomes so instantly important that good business sense dictates that you abandon the others and concentrate all your efforts."
"And that's what's happened with the e-banking thing?" Randy says.
"Yes. During our meetings at the Sultan's Palace," Avi says. "Before those meetings, we envisioned, well, you know what we envisioned. What actually happened was that the room was packed with these guys who were exclusively interested in the e-banking thing. That was our first clue. Then this."
He holds up his newspapers, whacks the dollar brandishing moppet with the back of his hand.
"So that's the business we're in now."
"We are bankers," Randy says.
He will have to keep saying this to himself for a while in order to believe it, like, "We are striving with all our might to uphold the goals of the 23rd Party Congress."
"We are bankers. We are bankers."
"Banks used to issue their own currencies. You can see these old banknotes in the Smithsonian. First National Bank of South Bumfuck will remit 10 pork bellies to the bearer, or whatever. That had to stop because commerce became non-local. You needed to be able to take your money with you when you went out west or whatever."
"But if we're online, the whole world is local," Randy says.
"Yeah. so all we need is something to back the currency. Gold would be good.
Gold?
Are you joking? Isn't that kind of old-fashioned?
It was, until all of the unbacked currencies in Southeast Asia went down the toilet.
Avi, so far I am still kind of confused, frankly. You seem to be working your way around to telling me that my little trip to see the gold in the jungle was no coincidence. But how can we use that gold to back our currency?
Avi shrugs, as if it's such a minor detail he hasn't even bothered to think about it.
That's just a deal-making issue.
Oh, God.
These people who sent you a message want to get into business with us. Your trip to see the gold was a credit check.
They are walking through a tunnel toward the garage, stuck behind an extended clan of Southeast Asians in elaborate headdresses. Perhaps the entire remaining gene pool of some nearly extinct mountain-dwelling minority group. Their belongings are in giant boxes wrapped in iridescent pink synthetic twine, balanced atop airport luggage carts.
A credit check.
Randy always hates it when he gets so far behind Abby that all he can do is lamely repeat phrases.
You know how, when you and Charlene bought that house, the lender had to look at it first?
I bought it for cash.
Okay, but in general, before a bank will issue a mortgage on a house, they will inspect it. Not in great detail, necessarily. They'll just have some executive of the bank drive by the property to verify that it exists and is where the documents claim it is and so on.
So, that's what my journey to the jungle was about?
Yeah. Some of the potential participants in the project just wanted to make it clear to us that they were, in fact, in possession of this gold.
I really have to wonder what possession denotes in this case.
Me too, Abby says. I've been sort of puzzling over that one.
Hence, Randy thinks, the frowny look at the airport.
I just thought they wanted to sell it, Randy says.
Why? Why sell it?
To liquidate it? So they could buy real estate or 5,000 pairs of shoes or something?
Avi scrunches his face in disappointment.
Oh, Randy, that is really unworthy, alluding to the Marcoses. The gold you saw is pocket change compared to what Ferdinand Marcos dug up.
The people who set up your trip to the jungle are satellites of him.
Well, consider it a cry for help, Randy says. Words seem to be passing back and forth between us, but I understand less and less.
Avi opens his mouth to respond, but just then the animists trigger their car alarm. Unable to propitiate it, they form a circle around the car and grin at one another. Avi and Randy pick up their pace and get well away from it. Avi stops and straightens, as if pulled up short.
Speaking of not understanding things, he says, you need to communicate with that girl, Amy Shafto.
Has she been communicating with you?
In the course of 20 minutes phone conversation, she is deeply and eternally bonded with Kia, Abby says.
I would believe that without hesitation.
It wasn't even like they got to know each other. It was like they knew each other in a previous life and had just gotten back in touch.
Yeah, so?
Kia now feels bound by duty and honor to present a united front with America Shafto.
It all hangs together, Randy says.
Acting sort of like Amy's emotional agent or a lawyer, she has made it clear to me that we, Epiphyte Corporation, owe Amy our full attention and concern.
And what does Amy want?
That was my question, Avi says. And I was made to feel very bad for asking it. Whatever it is that we, that you, owe to Amy is something so obvious that merely manifesting a need to verbalize it is just, really
shabby, insensitive,
coarse, brutish.
A really transparent, toddler-level exercise in the cheapest kind
of evasion of personal responsibility for one's own gross misdeeds.
Q was rolling her eyes, I imagine. Her lip was sort of curled.
She drew breath as if to give me a good piece of her mind, but then thought better of it.
Not because you're her boss, but because you would never understand.
This is just one of those evils that has to be sort of accepted and swallowed by any mature woman who's been around the block.
Who knows the harsh realities?
Yeah, Randy says.
Yep. Okay, you can tell Kia that her client's needs and demands have been communicated to the guilty party.
Have they?
Tell her that the fact that her client has needs and demands has been heavy-handedly insinuated to me and that it is understood that the ball is in my court.
And we can stand down to some kind of detente while a response is prepared?
Certainly. Kia can return to her normal duties for the time being.
Thank you, Randy.
Abby's Range Rover is parked in the most remote part of the roof of the parking ramp, in the center of about 25 empty parking spaces that form a sort of security buffer zone. When they have traversed about half of the glacis, the car's headlights flutter, and Randy hears the preparatory snap of a sound system being energized.
"Ah, the Range Rover has picked us up on Doppler radar," Abby says hastily.
The Range Rover speaketh in a fearsome Oz-like voice cranked up to burning bush decibel levels.
"You are being tracked by Cerberus. Please alter your course immediately."
"I can't believe you bought one of these things," Randy says.
"You have encroached on the Cerberus defensive perimeter. Move back, move back,"
says the Range Rover.
"An armed response team is being placed on standby."
"It is the only cryptographically sound car alarm system," Abby says,
as if that settles the matter. He digs out a keychain attached to a black polycarbonate fob with the same dimensions and number of buttons as a television remote control. He enters a long series of digits and cuts off the voice in the middle of proclaiming that Randy and Abby are being recorded on a digital video camera that is sensitive in the near-infrared range.
"Normally it doesn't do that," Abby says. "I had it set to its maximum alert status."
"What's the worst that could happen? Someone would steal your car and the insurance company would buy you a new one?"
"I couldn't care less if it gets stolen. The worst that could happen would be a car bomb. Or not quite as bad, someone putting a bug in my car and listening to everything I say."
Abby drives Randy over the San Andreas Fault to his place in Pacifica, which is where Randy stores his car while he's overseas. Abby's wife, Deborah, is in at the doctor's for a routine prenatal, and all the kids are either at school or being hustled around the neighborhood by their tag-team duo of tough Israeli nannies. Abby's nannies have the souls of war-hardened Soviet paratroopers in the bodies of nubile 18-year-old girls. The house has been utterly abandoned to kid-raising. The formal dining room has been converted to a nanny barracks, with bunk beds hammered together from unfinished 2x4s, the parlor filled with cribs and changing tables, and every square centimeter of cheap shag carpet in the place has been infused with a few dozen flakes of glitter in various festive colors, which, if they even cared about getting rid of it, could only be removed through direct microsurgical extraction, one flake at a time. Abby plies Randy with a sandwich of turkey bologna and ketchup on generic Wonderoid bread. It is still too early in Manila for Randy to call Amy and make amends for whatever he did wrong. Down below them, in Abby's basement office, a fax machine shrieks and rustles like a bird in a coffee can. A laminated CIA map of Sierra Leone is spread out on the table, peeking out here and there through numerous overlying strata of dirty dishes, newspapers, coloring books, and drafts of the Epiphyte II business plan. Post-it notes are stuck to the map from place to place. Written on each note, in Avi's distinctive triple-aught rapidograph drafting pen hand, is a latitude and longitude with lots of significant digits and some kind of précis of what happened there. 5 women, 2 men, 4 children, with machetes, photos, and then serial numbers from Abby's database. Randy was a little groggy on the drive over and was irritable about the inappropriate daylight, but after the sandwich, his metabolism tries to get into the spirit of things. He has learned to surf these mysterious endocrinological swells.
"I'm gonna get going," he says, and stands. "Your overall plan again?"
"First, I go south," Randy says, superstitiously, not even wanting to utter the name of the place where he used to live.
"For no more than a day, I hope. Then jet lag will land on me like a plunging safe, and I will hole up somewhere and watch basketball through the V of my feet for maybe a day. Then I head north to the Palouse country."
Abby raises his eyebrows.
"Home?"
"Yeah."
"Hey, before I forget, could you look for information on the Whitmans while you're up there?"
"You mean the missionaries?"
"Yeah. They came out to the Palouse to convert the Cayuse Indians, who were these magnificent horsemen. They had the best of intentions, but they accidentally gave them measles, annihilated the whole tribe."
"Does that really land within the boundaries of your obsession, inadvertent genocide?"
"Anomalous cases of heightened utility in that they help us delineate the boundaries of the field."
"I'll see what I can find about the Whitmans."
"May I inquire," Abby says, "why you are going up there? Family visit?"
Yeah, my grandmother is moving to a managed care facility. Her children are convening to divide up her furniture and so on, which I find a little ghoulish, but it's nobody's fault and it has to be done. And you are going to participate. I'm going to avoid it as much as I can because it's probably going to be a catfight. Years from now, family members will still not be speaking to each other because they didn't get Mom's Gomer Ballstrud credenza. What is it with Anglo-Saxons and furniture? Could you explain that to me? I am going because we found a piece of paper in a briefcase in a sunken Nazi submarine in the Palawan Passage that says, Waterhouse, Lavender Rose. Avi looks baffled now in a way that Randy finds satisfying. He gets up and climbs into his car and starts driving south, down the coast, the slow and beautiful way. Oregon. Lawrence Waterhouse's libido is suppressed for about a week by the pain and swelling in his jaw. Then the pain and swelling in his groin surges into the fore, and he begins searching his memories of the dance, wondering if he made any progress with Mary Scamithid. He wakes up suddenly at 4 o'clock one Sunday morning, clammily coated from his nipples to his knees. Rod is still sleeping soundly, thank God, and so if Waterhouse did any moaning or calling out of names during his dream, Rod's probably not aware of it. Waterhouse begins trying to clean himself off without making a lot of noise. He doesn't even want to think about how he's going to explain the condition of the sheets to who will launder them.
It was completely innocent, Mrs. McTeague. I dreamed that I came downstairs in my pajamas and that Mary was sitting in the parlor in her uniform drinking tea, and she turned and looked me in the eye, and then I just couldn't control myself and... And then I woke up and just look at the mess.
Mrs. McTeague and other old ladies like her all around the world does the laundry only because it is her role in the giant ejaculation control conspiracy, which, as Waterhouse is belatedly realizing, controls the entire planet. No doubt she has a clipboard down in the cellar, next to her mangle, where she marks down the frequency and volume of the ejaculations of her four boarders. The data sheets are mailed into some Bletchley Park type of operation somewhere. Waterhouse guesses it's disguised as a large convent in upstate New York, where the numbers from all round the world are tabulated on Electrical Till Corporation machines and printouts piled up on carts that are wheeled into the offices of the high priestesses of the conspiracy, dressed in heavily starched white raiments, embroidered with the emblem of the conspiracy, a penis caught in a mangle. The priestesses review the data carefully. They observe that Hitler still isn't getting any and debate whether letting him have some would calm him down a little bit or just give him license to run further out of control. It will take months for the name of Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse to come up to the top of the list, and months for orders to be sent out to Brisbane. And even then, the orders may condemn him to another year of waiting for Mary Scamithid to show up in his dreams with a teacup. Mrs. McTeague and other ECC members, such as Mary Scamithid and basically all of the other young women, are offended by easy girls, prostitutes, and whorehouses, not for religious reasons, but because they provide a refuge where men can have ejaculations that are not controlled, metered, or monitored in any way. Prostitutes are turncoats, collaborators. All of this comes into Waterhouse's mind as he lies in his damp bed between 4 and 6 o'clock in the morning, considering his place in the world with the crystalline clarity that can only be obtained by getting a good night's sleep and then venting several weeks' jism production. He has reached a fork in the road. Last night, before Rod turned in, he shined his shoes, explaining that tomorrow morning he had to be up bright and early for church. Now Waterhouse knows what that means, having spent many a Sabbath on Tagum, cringing and blushing under the glares of the locals who were outraged that he appeared to be running the Huffduff equipment on the day of rest. He has seen them shuffling into their morbid 1,000-year-old Blackstone Chapel on Sunday mornings for their 3-hour services. Hell, Waterhouse even lived in a Tagmian chapel for several months. Its gloom suffused his whole being. Going to church with Rod would mean giving in to the ECC, becoming their minion. The alternative is the whorehouse. Even though he grew up in churches, raised by church people,
Waterhouse, as must be obvious by this point, never really understood their attitudes about sex. Why did they get so hung up on that one issue, when there are others like murder, war, poverty, and pestilence? Now, finally, he gets it. The churches are merely one branch of the ECC, and what they are doing when they fulminate about sex is trying to make sure that all the young people fall in line with the ECC's program. So, what is the end result of the ECC's efforts? Waterhouse stares at the ceiling, which is starting to become fuzzily visible as the sun rises in the west, or the north, or wherever the hell it rises here in the southern hemisphere. He takes a quick inventory of the world and finds that basically the ECC is running the entire planet, good countries and bad countries alike. That all successful and respected men are minions of the ECC, or at least are so scared of it that they pretend to be. Non-ECC members live on the fringes of society, like prostitutes, or have been driven deep underground and must waste tremendous amounts of time and energy keeping up a false front. If you knuckle under and become a minion of the ECC, you get to have a career, a family, kids, wealth, house, pot roasts, clean laundry, and the respect of all the other ECC minions. You have to pay dues in the form of chronic nagging sexual irritation, which can only be relieved by, and at the discretion and convenience of, one person, the person designated for this role by the ECC, your wife. On the other hand, if you reject the ECC and its works, you can't, by definition, have a family, and your career options are limited to pimp, gangster, and 40-year enlisted sailor. Hell, it's not even that bad of a conspiracy. They build churches and universities, educate kids, install swing sets and parks. Sometimes they throw a war and kill 10 or 20 million people, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to stuff like influenza, which the ECC campaigns against by nagging everyone to wash their hands and cover their mouths when sneezing. The alarm clock. Rod rolls out of bed like it's a nip air raid. Waterhouse stares at the ceiling for another few minutes, dithering. But he knows where he's going, and there's no point in wasting any more time. He's going to church, and not exactly because he has renounced Satan and all his works, but because he wants to fuck Mary. He almost can't help flinching when he says to himself this terrible-sounding thing. But the weird thing about church is that it provides a special context within which it is perfectly okay to want to fuck Mary. As long as he goes to church, he can want to fuck Mary as much as he wants. He can spend all of his time in and out of church thinking about fucking Mary. He can let her know that he wants to fuck her as long as he finds a more oblique way of phrasing it. And if he jumps through certain hoops, hoops of gold, he can even fuck Mary in actuality. And it will all be perfectly acceptable. At no time will he have to feel the slightest trace of shame or guilt. He rolls out of bed, startling Rod, who, being some sort of jungle commando, is easily startled. "I'm gonna fuck your cousin until the bed collapses into a pile of splinters," Waterhouse says. Actually, what he says is, "I'm going to church with you." But Waterhouse, the cryptologist, is engaging in a bit of secret code work here. He is using a newly invented code, which only he knows. It will be very dangerous if the code is ever broken, but this is impossible since there is only one copy and it's in Waterhouse's head. Turing might be smart enough to break the code anyway, but he's in England, and he's on Waterhouse's side, so he'd never tell. A few minutes later, Waterhouse and Skimithid go downstairs, headed for church, which in Waterhouse's secret code means headquarters of the Merry Fucking Campaign of 1944. As they step out into the cool morning air, they can hear Mrs. McTeague bustling into their bedroom to strip their beds and inspect their sheets. Waterhouse smiles, thinking that he has just gotten away with something. The damning and overwhelming evidence found on his bed linens will be neatly canceled out by the fact that he got up early and went to church. He is expecting a prayer group meeting in the basement of a dry goods store, but it turns out that the Intertagmians got banished to Australia in droves. Many of them settled in Brisbane. In the downtown, they managed to construct a united ecclesiastical church out of rough-hewn beige sandstone.
It would look big, solid, and almost opulent if it were not directly across the street from the Universal Ecclesiastical Church, which is twice as big and made of smooth-faced limestone. Outer Tagmians, dressed in dour blacks and grays, and frequently in navy uniforms, shuffle up the wide, time-blackened steps of the Universal Ecclesiastical Church, occasionally turning their heads to throw disapproving looks across the street at the inner Tagmians, who are actually dressed for the season. It is summer in Australia, or in army uniforms. Waterhouse can see that what really pisses them off is the sound of music that vents from the United Ecclesiastical Church whenever its red enameled front doors are hauled open. The choir is practicing, and the organ is playing. But he can tell from half a block away that something's wrong with the instrument. The look of the inner Tagmian women in their pastel dresses and bright bonnets is reassuring. These do not look like people who engage in human sacrifice. Waterhouse tries to spring lightly up the steps as if he really wants to be here. Then he remembers that he does want to be here, because it is all part of his plan to fuck Mary. The churchgoers are all talking in Tagmian, greeting each other and saying nice things to Rod, who is evidently well thought of. Waterhouse has no idea what they are saying and finds it comforting to know that most of them don't either. He strolls into the central aisle of the church, stares down its vault to the altar, the choir behind it, singing beautifully. Mary is there, in the alto section, exercising those pipes of hers which are framed attractively by the satin stole of her chorister's uniform. Above and behind the choir, a big old pipe organ spreads its tarnished wings like a stuffed and mounted eagle that's been sitting in a damp attic for 50 years. It wheezes and hisses asthmatically and emits bizarre discordant drones when certain stops are used. This happens when a valve is stuck open, and it is called a cipher. Waterhouse knows all about ciphers. Notwithstanding the pathetic organ, the choir is spectacular and builds to a stirring six-part harmony climax as Waterhouse ambles up the aisle, wondering whether his erection is visible. A shaft of light comes in through the stained glass rosette above the organ pipes and pinions Waterhouse in its gaudy beam. Or maybe it just feels that way because Waterhouse has it all figured out now. Waterhouse is going to fix the church's organ. This project will be sure to have side benefits for his own organ, a single-pipe instrument that needs attention just as badly. It turns out that, like all ethnic groups that have been consistently screwed for a long time, the inner Tagmians have great music. Not only that, they actually have fun in church. The minister actually has a sense of humor. It's about as tolerable as church could ever be. Waterhouse hardly pays attention because he is doing a lot of staring, first at Mary, then at the organ, trying to figure out how it is engineered, then back to Mary for a while. He is outraged and offended after the service, when the powers that be are reluctant to let him, a total stranger and a Yank to boot, begin ripping off access panels and meddling with the inner workings of the organ. The minister is a good judge of character, a little too good to suit Waterhouse. The organist, and hence ultimate authority on all matters organic, looks to have been shipped over here with the very first load of convicts after having been convicted in the Old Bailey of talking too loud, bumping into things, not tying his shoelaces properly, and having dandruff so in excess of society's unwritten standards as to offend the dignity of the Queen and of the Empire. It all leads to an unbearably tense and complicated meeting in a Sunday school classroom near the offices of the minister, who is called the Reverend Dr. John Milroy. He is a stout, red-faced chap who clearly would prefer to have his head in a ton of ale, but who is putting up with all of this because it's good for his immortal soul. This meeting essentially becomes a venue within which the organist, Mr. Durek, can vent his opinions on the sneakiness of the Japanese, why the invention of the well-tempered tuning system was a bad idea, and how all music written since has been a shabby compromise, the sterling qualities of the general, the numerological significance of the lengths of various organ pipes, how the excessive libido of American troops might be controlled with certain dietary supplements, how the hauntingly beautiful modes of traditional Tagmian music are particularly ill-suited to the well-tempered tuning system. How the king's dodgy Germanic relatives are plotting to take over the empire and turn it over to Hitler. And, first and foremost, that Johann Sebastian Bach was a bad musician, a worse composer, an evil man, a philanderer, and the figurehead of a worldwide conspiracy headquartered in Germany that has been slowly taking over the world for the last several hundred years, using the well-tempered tuning system as a sort of carrier frequency, on which its ideas, which originate with the Bavarian Illuminati, can be broadcast into the minds of everyone who listens to music, especially the music of Bach. And, by the way, how this conspiracy may best be fought off by playing and listening to traditional Tagmian music, which, in case Mr. Druck didn't make this perfectly clear, is wholly incompatible with well-tempered tuning because of its haunting and beautiful but numerologically perfect scale. "Your thoughts on numerology are most interesting," Waterhouse says loudly, running Mr. Druck off the rhetorical road. "I myself studied with Drs. Turing and von Neumann at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton." Father John snaps awake, and Mr. Druck looks as if he's just taken a 50-caliber round in the small of his back. Clearly, Mr. Druck has had a long career of being the weirdest person in any given room, but he's about to go down in flames. In general, Waterhouse isn't good at just winging it, but he's tired and pissed off and horny, and this is a fucking war, and sometimes you have to. He mounts the podium, dives for a round of chalk, and starts hammering equations onto the blackboard like an ack-ack gun. He uses well-tempered tuning as a starting point, takes off from there into the deepest realms of advanced number theory, circles back all of a sudden to the Tagmian modal scale, just to keep them on their toes, and then actually stumbles across some interesting material that he doesn't think has been covered in the literature yet, and so he diverts from strict bullshitting for a few minutes to explore this thing and actually prove something that he thinks could probably be published in a mathematical journal, if he just gets around to typing it up properly. It reminds him that he's not half bad at this stuff when he's recently ejaculated, and that in turn just fuels his resolve to get this merry-fucking thing worked out. Finally, he turns around for the first time since he started. Father John and Mr. Druck are both dumbfounded. "Let me just demonstrate," Waterhouse blurts, and strides out of the room and doesn't bother looking back. Back in the church, he goes to the console, blows the dandruff off the keys, hits the main power switch. The electric motors come on somewhere back behind the screen, and the instrument begins to complain and whine. No matter, it can all be drowned out. He scans the row of stops. He already knows what this organ's got because he's listened and deconstructed. He starts yanking out knobs. Now Waterhouse is going to demonstrate that Bach can sound good even played on Mr. Druck's organ, if you choose the right key. Just as Father John and Mr. Druck are about halfway up the aisle, Waterhouse slams into that old chestnut, Toccata and Fugue in D minor. Except that he's transposing it into C-sharp minor as he goes along, because, according to a very elegant calculation that just came into his head as he was running up the aisle of the church, it ought to sound good that way when played in Mr. Druck's mangled tuning system. The transposition is an awkward business at first, and he hits a few wrong notes, but then it comes naturally, and he transitions from the toccata into the fugue with tremendous verve and confidence. Gouts of dust and salvos of mouse droppings explode from the pipes as Waterhouse invokes whole ranks that have not been used in decades. Many of these are big, bad, loud reed stops that are difficult to tune. Waterhouse senses the pumping machinery straining to keep up with this unprecedented demand for power. The choir loft is suffused with a brilliant glow as the dust flung out of the choked pipes fills the air and catches the light coming through the rose window. Waterhouse muffs a pedal line, spitefully kicks off his terrible shoes, and begins to tread the pedals the way he used to back in Virginia, with his bare feet, the trajectory of the bass line traced out across the wooden pedals in lines of blood from his exploded blisters. This baby has some nasty 32-foot reed stops in the pedals, real earth shakers, probably put there specifically to irritate the outer Tagmians across the street. None of the people who go to this church have ever heard these stops called into action, but Waterhouse puts them to good use now, firing off power cores like salvos from the mighty guns of the battleship Iowa. All during the service, during the sermon and the scripture readings and the prayers, when he wasn't thinking about fucking Mary, he was thinking about how he was going to fix this organ. He was thinking back to the organ he worked on in Virginia, how the stops enabled the flow of air to the different ranks of pipes, and how the keys on the keyboards activated all of the pipes that were enabled. He has this whole organ visualized in his head now, and while he is pounding through to the end of the fugue, the top of his skull comes off. The filtered red light pours in. He sees the entire machine in his mind, as if in an exploded draftsman's view. Then it transforms itself into a slightly different machine, an organ that runs on electricity with ranks of vacuum tubes here and a grid of relays there. He has the answer now to Turing's question, the question of how to take a pattern of binary data and bury it into the circuitry of a thinking machine so that it can be later disinterred. Waterhouse knows how to make electric memory. He must go write a letter to Alan instantly. "Excuse me," he says, and runs from the church. On his way out, he brushes past a small young woman who has been standing there gaping at his performance. When he is several blocks away, he realizes two things: that he is walking down the street barefoot, and that the young woman was Mary Scamithid. He will have to circle back later and get his shoes and maybe fuck her. But first things first. Home. Randy opens his eyes from out of a sliding nightmare. He was in his car, driving down the Pacific Coast Highway, when something went wrong with the steering. The car began to wander, first towards the vertical stone cliff on the left, and then towards the sheer drop to huge jagged rocks projecting from thrashing waves on the right. Big rocks were rolling nonchalantly across the highway. He could not steer. The only way to stop moving is to open his eyes. He is lying on a sleeping bag on a polished maple floor that is not level, and that is why he had the sliding dream. The eye-inner ear conflict makes his body spasm. He flails to plant both hands against the plane of the floor. America Shafto sits, jeaned and barefoot, in the blue light of a window, bobby pins sprouting from chapped lips, looking at her face in an isosceles triangle of mirror whose scalpel-sharp edges depress but do not cut the pink skin of her fingertips. A web of lead ropes sags in the empty window frame, a few lozenges of beveled glass still trapped in the interstices. Randy lifts his head slightly and looks downhill into the corner of the room and sees a great heap of swept shards. He rolls over, looks out the door and across the hallway and into what used to be Charlene's home office. Robin and Marcus Aurelius Shafto are sharing a double mattress in there, a shotgun and a rifle, a couple of big black cop flashlights, a Bible and a calculus textbook, neatly arranged on the floor next to them. The nightmare's feeling of panic, of needing to go somewhere and do something, subsides. Lying here in his ruined house, listening to Amy's brush whistle through her hair, throwing off electrostatic snaps, is one of the calmer moments he's had.
"You just about ready to hit the road?" Amy says.
Across the hallway, one of the Shafto boys sits up without making any sound. The other opens his eyes, lifts his head, glances towards the weapons, lights, and good book, then relaxes again.
"I got a fire going out in the yard," Amy says, "and some water boiling. Didn't think it was safe to use the fireplace."
Everyone slept in their clothes last night. All they have to do is put their shoes on and piss out the windows. The Shaftos move about the place faster than Randy does, not because they are more sure-footed, but because they never saw this house when it was level and sound. But Randy lived here for years and years when it was, and his mind thinks it knows its way around the place. Going to bed last night, his biggest fear was that he would get up drowsily in the middle of the night and try to go downstairs. The house used to have a beautiful winding stairway, which is now telescoped into the basement. Last night, by dint of pulling the U-Haul onto the front lawn and aiming its headlights directly in through windows, whose cracks and jags and facets refracted the light gorgeously, they were able to clamber into the basement and find a 10-foot aluminum extension ladder, which they used to get into the upstairs. Once they had gotten up, they pulled the ladder up with them, like a drawbridge, so that even if looters did enter the downstairs, the Shafto boys would be able to sit at the top of what used to be the stairway and pick them off leisurely with the long guns. This scenario seemed plausible last night in the dark, but now strikes Randy as a bumpkin's reverie. Amy's turned some balusters from the veranda's railing into a nice bonfire in the front yard. She stomps a crushed saucepan back into shape with a small number of deftly aimed heel strokes and cooks oatmeal. The Shafto boys throw whatever looks potentially useful into the back of the U-Haul and check the oil in their hot rod. All of Charlene's stuff is in New Haven now, in Dr. G.E.B. Kavistic's house, to be specific. He has generously offered to let her stay there while she looks for a house. Randy predicts she'll never leave. All of Randy's stuff is in Manila, or in Abby's basement, and all of the disputed items are in a storage locker at the edge of town. Randy spent most of yesterday evening cruising around town, checking in on various old friends to see if they were all right. Amy went with him, taking a voyeuristic interest in this tour of his former life and, from a social point of view, complicating things incalculably. In any case, they didn't make it back to the house until after dark, and so this is Randy's first chance to see the damage in full daylight. He orbits it again and again, amused, almost to the point of giggling, by how perfectly destroyed it is, taking pictures with a disposable camera he borrowed from Marcus Aurelius Shafto, trying to see if there is anything left that could conceivably be worth money. The house's stone foundation rises 3 feet above grade. The wooden walls of the house were built on top of that, but not actually attached to it, a common practice in the old days, which, at the time he blew town, was on Randy's list of things to fix before the next earthquake. When the earth began to oscillate side to side at 2:16 in the afternoon yesterday, the foundation oscillated right along with it, but the house wanted to stay where it was. Eventually, the foundation wall moved right out from underneath the house, one corner of which dropped 3 feet to the ground. Randy could probably estimate the amount of kinetic energy the house picked up during this fall and convert it to an equivalent in pounds of dynamite or swings of a wrecking ball, but it would be a nerdy exercise since he can see the effects for himself. Let's just say that when it smashed to earth, the whole structure suffered a vicious shock. The parallel upright joists in the floors all went horizontal, collapsing like dominoes. Every window and doorframe instantly became a parallelogram, so all of the glass broke, and in particular, all of the leaded glass was rent asunder. The stairway fell into the basement. The chimney, which had been in need of tuck-pointing for some time, sprayed bricks all over the yard. Most of the plumbing was wrecked, which means that the heating system is history since the house used radiators. The plaster fell from the lath everywhere, cumulative tons of old horsehair plaster just exploding out of the walls and ceilings and mixing with the water from the busted plumbing to make a gray slurry that congealed in the downhill corners of the rooms. The handcrafted Italian tiles that Charlene picked out for the bathrooms are 75% broken. The granite counters in the kitchen are now seamed tectonic systems. A few of the major appliances look repairable, but ownership of those was in dispute anyway.
"It's a teardown, sir,"
says Robin Shafto. He has spent his whole life in some Tennessee mountain town, living in trailers and cabins, but even he has enough real estate acumen to sense this.
"Is there something you wanted to get out of the basement, sir?"
says Marcus Aurelius Shafto. Randy laughs.
"There's a filing cabinet down there.
Wait!"
He reaches out and puts a hand on Marcus's shoulder to prevent him from sprinting into the house and diving like Tarzan into the stairway pit.
"The reason I wanted it was because it contains every single receipt for every penny I put into this house. See, it was a wreck when I bought it. Sort of like it is now. Maybe not as bad.
You need those papers for your divorce?"
Randy stops and clears his throat in mild exasperation. He has explained to them 5 times that he was never married to Charlene, and so it's not a divorce. But this idea of living with a woman to whom one is not married is so embarrassing to the Tennessee branch of the Shaftos that they simply cannot process it. And so they keep talking about your ex-wife and your divorce. Noting Randy's hesitation, Robin says, "Or for the insurance?" Randy laughs with surprising heartiness.
"You did get insurance, didn't you, sir?"
"Earthquake insurance around here is basically unobtainable," Randy says. This is the first time it dawns on any of the Shaftos that as of 2:16 p.m. yesterday afternoon, in an instant, Randy's net worth dropped by something like $300,000. They skulk away from him and leave him alone for a while, taking pictures to document the loss. Amy comes over.
"Oatmeal's ready," she says.
"Okay." She stands close to him with her arms folded. The town is uncannily quiet. The power is off and few vehicles are on the streets.
"I'm sorry I ran you off the road."
Randy looks at his Acura, the gouge high on the left rear fender where the bumper of Amy's U-Haul truck took him from behind, and the crumpled front right bumper where he was forced into a parked Ford Fiesta.
Don't worry about it. If I'd known, Jesus, the last thing you need is a body shop bill on top of everything else. I'll pay for it.
Seriously, don't worry about it.
Well, Amy, I know perfectly well you don't give a shit about my stupid car, and when you pretend otherwise, the strain shows.
You're right. But I'm sorry I misapprehended the situation.
It was my fault, Randy says.
I should have explained why I was coming here.
Why the hell did you rent a U-Haul anyway? They were all out of regular cars at the San Francisco airport, some kind of big convention at the Moscone Center, so I displayed adaptability.
This phrase is a Douglas MacArthur Shafto parody.
How the hell did you get here so fast? I thought I took the last flight out of Manila. I got to Nye only a few minutes after you did, Randy. Your flight was full. I got on the next flight to Tokyo. I think my flight actually took off before yours did.
Mine was delayed on the ground.
Then from Narita, I just grabbed the next flight to SFO. Landed a couple of hours after you. So I was surprised that you and I pulled into town here at the same time.
I stopped over at a friend's house, and I took the scenic route.
Randy closes his eyes for a moment, remembering those loose boulders on the Pacific Coast Highway, the roadway shaking beneath the tires of his Acura.
See, when I saw your car, that's when I felt that God was with me, or something, Amy said.
Or with you.
God was with me?
How do you figure?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you that I left Manila not out of concern for you, but out of burning rage and a desire to just feed your ass on a plate.
I figured.
It's not even clear to me that you and I constitute a potential couple. But you have started acting towards me in a way that indicates some interest in that direction, so you have certain obligations.
Amy has now started to get pissed off and begun to move around the yard. The Shafto boys eye her warily from across their steaming oatmeal bowls, ready to spring into action and wrestle her to the ground if she should fly out of control.
It'll be just totally unacceptable for you to make those kind of representations to me and then jet off and cuddle with your California sweetheart without coming to me first and going through certain formalities, which would be awkward, but which I would hope you would be man enough to endure, right?
Absolutely right. Never felt otherwise.
So, you can imagine how it looked.
I guess so. Assuming you have no faith in me whatsoever.
Well, I'm sorry for that. But I will say that on the flight over, I began to think that it wasn't your fault that Charlene had somehow gotten to you.
What do you mean, gotten to me?
Amy looks at the ground.
I don't know. She must have some kind of hold over you.
I think not.
Randy sighs.
Anyway, I thought that maybe you were just in the process of making a big, stupid mistake. So when I got on that plane in Tokyo, I was just going to track you down and...
She draws a deep breath and mentally counts to 10.
But when I got off that plane, I was to boot just obsessed with this disgusting image of you getting back together with this woman who obviously was no damn good for you. And I felt that would be an unfortunate outcome for you. And I thought I was too late to do anything about it. So when I got into town and pulled around the corner and saw your Acura in the lane right there in front of me, and you talking on your cell phone...
I was leaving a message on your answering machine in Manila, Randy says, explaining that I was just coming here to pick up some papers,
and there had been an earthquake only minutes before, and so I might be a while.
Well, I didn't have time to check my messages, which were placed on my machine too late to accomplish any useful purpose, Amy says. And so I had to go on my imperfect knowledge of those events, since no one had bothered to fill me in. So, I felt that cooler heads should prevail.
And therefore you ran me off the road?
Amy looks a little disappointed. She takes a patient Montessori preschool teacher tone of voice. Now, Randy, think about priorities for just a minute. I could see the way you were driving.
I was in a hurry to find out whether I was totally destitute or merely bankrupt.
But because of my imperfect knowledge of the situation, I thought maybe you were rushing into your poor little Charlene's arms. In other words, that the emotional stress of the earthquake might induce you to... who knows what relationship-wise?
Randy presses his lips together and takes a huge breath through his nose.
Compared to that, a little bit of sheet metal just was not very important to me.
Of course, I know that a lot of guys would just stand back and allow someone they cared about to do something extremely foolish and damaging, only so that everyone concerned could then drive off to a miserable and emotionally fucked up future in perfect shiny cars.
Randy can do nothing but roll his eyes.
Well, he says, I am sorry that I blew up at you when I got out of the car.
You are? Why exactly? You should be pissed off when a truck driver runs you off the road.
I didn't know who you were. I didn't recognize you in this context. It did not occur to me that you would do what you did with the airplanes.
Amy laughs in a goofy, mischievous way that doesn't seem right here.
Randy feels quizzical and mildly irritated. She looks at him knowingly.
I'll bet you never blew up at Charlene.
That's right, Randy says.
You didn't? In all those years?
When we had issues, we talked them out.
Amy snorts.
I bet you had really boring...
She stops herself. Boring what? Never mind.
Look, I think that in a good relationship, you have to have ways for working out any issues that might come up,
Randy says reasonably. And you don't consider ramming your car a good way, I'll bet.
I can think of some problems with it.
And you had ways of working out your problems with Charlene that were very sophisticated. No voices were ever raised, no angry words exchanged.
No cars rammed.
Yeah, and that worked, right?
Randy sighs.
How about that thing that Charlene wrote about beards? Amy asks.
How did you know about that?
Looked it up on the internet. Was that an example of how you guys worked out your problems? By publishing totally oblique academic papers blasting the other person?
I feel like having some oatmeal.
So don't apologize to me for blowing up at me.
That oatmeal would really hit the spot.
For having and showing emotion.
Chow time!
Because that's what it's all about. That's the name of the game, Randy boy,
she says, pulling abreast of him and whacking him between the shoulder blades in a gesture inherited from her dad.
That oatmeal does smell good.
The caravan pulls out of town a little after noon. Randy leading the way in his damaged Acura, Amy sitting in the passenger seat with her bare, tanned feet up on the dashboard, spoked with white lines from the straps of her high-tech sandals, oblivious to the danger, alluded to by Randy, of her legs being snapped by an airbag deployment. The souped-up Impala is driven by its owner of record and chief engineer, Marcus Aurelius Shafto. Bringing up the rear, the almost totally empty U-Haul truck, driven by Robin Shafto. Randy has that moving through syrup feeling he gets when enacting some emotionally huge transition in his life. He puts Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings on the Acura stereo and drives very slowly down the main street of the town, looking all around at the remains of the coffee houses, bars, pizza places, and Thai restaurants where, for many years, he prosecuted his social life. He should have performed this little ceremony before he first left for Manila a year and a half ago. But then he fled, as if from the scene of a crime, or at least a grotesque personal embarrassment. He only had a day or two before he got on the plane, and he spent most of it on the floor of Abby's basement, dictating whole swathes of the business plan into a microcassette recorder, as opposed to typing them because his hands had gone carpal. He never even properly said goodbye to most of the people he knew here,
He did not speak to them and barely thought of them until yesterday evening, when he pulled up in front of their skewed and occasionally smoking homes in his crumpled and U-Haul orange-streaked car, with this strange, wiry, tanned woman who, whatever strengths and shortcomings she might have, was not Charlene. So, taking everything into account, it was not precisely the way that Emily Post would have orchestrated a reunion with out-of-touch friends. The evening's tour is still a flurry of odd, emotionally charged images in his memory, but he's beginning to sort it out a little, to run the numbers, as it were, and he would say that of the people he ran into yesterday, people he had exchanged dinner invitations with and loaned tools to, people whose personal computers he had debugged in exchange for six-packs of good beer, whom he had seen important movies with, that at least three-quarters of these people have really no interest whatsoever in seeing Randy's face again as long as they live, and were made to feel intensely awkward by his totally unexpected reappearance in their front yards, where they were throwing impromptu parties with salvaged beer and wine. This hostility was pretty strongly gender-linked, Randy is sad to conclude. Many of the females wouldn't talk to him at all, or would come near him only the better to fix him with frosty glares and appraise his presumed new girlfriend. This only stands to reason, since before she left for Yale, Charlene had the better part of a year to popularize her version of events. She has been able to structure the discourse to her advantage, just like a dead white male. No doubt Randy has been classified as an abandoner, no better than the married man who up and walks out on his wife and children. Never mind that he was the one who wanted to marry her and have kids with her. But his whining alert starts to buzz when he thinks about that, so he backs up and tries another path. He embodies, he realizes, just about the worst nightmare for many women of what might happen in their lives. As for the men he saw last night, they were pretty strongly incensed to back whatever stance their wives adopted. Some of them really did, apparently, feel similarly. Others eyed him with obvious curiosity. Some were openly friendly. Weirdly, the ones who adopted the sternest and most terrible Old Testament moral tone were the modern language association types who believed that everything was relative and that, for example, polygamy was as valid as monogamy. The friendliest and most sincere welcome he'd gotten was from Scott, a chemistry professor, and Laura, a pediatrician, who, after knowing Randy and Charlene for many years, had one day divulged to Randy in strict confidence that, unbeknownst to the academic community at large, they had been spiriting their three children off to church every Sunday morning, and even had them all baptized. Randy had gone into their house once to help Scott wrestle a freshly reconditioned clawfoot bathtub up the stairs, and had actually seen the word God written on actual pieces of paper stuck to the walls of their house, like on the refrigerator door and the walls of the children's bedrooms, where juvenile art tends to be reposited. Little time-wasting projects they had done during Sunday school, pages torn from coloring books showing a somewhat more multicultural Jesus than the one Randy had grown up with, curly hair, for example, talking to little biblical kids or assisting disoriented Holy Land livestock. The sight of this stuff around the house, commingled with normal, that is, secular, kid art junk from elementary school, Batman posters, etc., made Randy feel grossly embarrassed. It was like going to the house of some supposedly sophisticated people and finding a neon on black velvet Elvis painting hanging above their state-of-the-art Italian designer furniture. Definitely a social class thing. And it wasn't like Scott and Laura were deadly earnest types, and neither were they glossy-eyed and foaming at the mouth. They had, after all, managed to pass themselves off as members in good standing of decent academic society for a number of years. They were a bit quieter than many others. They took up less space in the room. But then that was normal for people trying to raise three kids, and so they passed. Randy and Amy had spent a full hour talking to Scott and Laura last night. They were the only people who made any effort to make Amy feel welcome. Randy hadn't the faintest idea what these people thought of him and what he had done, but he could sense right away that, essentially, that was not the issue, because even if they thought he had done something evil, they at least had a framework, a sort of procedure manual for dealing with transgressions.
To translate it into Unix system administration terms, Randy's fundamental metaphor for just about everything, the postmodern politically correct atheists were like people who had suddenly found themselves in charge of a big and unfathomably complex computer system, namely society, with no documentation or instructions of any kind, and so whose only way to keep the thing running was to invent and enforce certain rules with a kind of neo-puritanical rigor, because they were at a loss to deal with any deviations from what they saw as the norm. Whereas people who are wired into a church were like Unix system administrators who, while they might not understand everything, at least had some documentation, some FAQs and how-tos and README files, providing some guidance on what to do when things got out of whack. They were, in other words, capable of displaying adaptability. "Yo, Randy," says America Shafto. "M.A. is honking at you." "Why?" Randy asks. He looks in the rear view, sees a reflection of the ceiling of the Acura, and realizes he is slouched way down in his seat. He sits up straight and spots the Impala. "I think it's because you're driving 10 miles an hour," Amy says. "And M.A. likes to go 90.
"Okay,"
Randy says, and just as simple as that, pushes down on the accelerator pedal and drives out of town forever.
Boondock. "The name of this place is Boondock," Captain Noda tells him confidently. "We have chosen it carefully."
Goto Dango and Lieutenant Mori are the only other persons present in the tent, but he speaks as if addressing a battalion drawn up on a parade ground. Goto Dango has been in the Philippines long enough to understand that in the local tongue, Boondock means any patch of rugged mountainous terrain, but he does not reckon that Captain Noda is the sort who would appreciate being brought up to speed by a subordinate. If Captain Noda says that this place is called Boondock, then Boondock it is, and forever will be. Captain is not an especially high rank, but Noda carries himself as if he's a general. Somewhere this man is important. He is pale-skinned, as if he's been spending the winter in Tokyo. His boots have not begun to rot on his feet yet. A hard leather attaché case rests on the table. He opens one end and draws out a large piece of folded white cloth. The two lieutenants scurry to assist him in unfolding this across the tabletop. Goto Dango is startled by the feel of the linen. His fingertips are the only part of his body that will ever touch bedsheets as fine as these. The Manila Hotel is printed along the cell edge. A diagram has been sketched out on the bedsheet. Blue-black fountain pen marks, punctuated with spreading blotches where the hand hesitated, reinforce an earlier stratum of graphite scratches. Someone terribly important, probably the last person to sleep on this bedsheet, has come in with a black grease pencil and reshaped the whole thing in his own image with fat, thrusting strokes and hasty notations that look like unraveled braids in a woman's long hair. This work has been annotated politely by a fastidious engineer, probably Captain Noda himself, working with ink and a fine brush. The heavy with the grease pencil has labeled the entire thing Boondock Site. Lieutenants Mori and Goto affix the sheet to the canvas of the tent, with some small, rusty cotter pins that a private brings to them triumphantly in a cracked porcelain coffee cup. Captain Noda watches calmly, puffing on a cigarette.
"Be careful," he jokes. "MacArthur slept on that sheet."
Lieutenant Mori dutifully cracks up. Goto Dango is standing on tiptoe, holding up the top edge of the sheet, examining the faint pencil marks underlying the whole diagram. He sees a couple of little crosses and, having spent too long in the Philippines, supposes at first that they are churches. In one place, three of them are clustered together, and he imagines Calvary. Nearby, diggings have been indicated. He thinks Golgotha, the place of the skull.
"Lunatic, he needs to get his mind in order."
Lieutenant Mori shoves pins through the linen with faint popping noises. Goto Dango steps away, keeping his back to the captain, closes his eyes, and gets his bearings. He is Nipponese. He is in the southern resource zone of Greater Nippon,
The cross-shaped marks represent summits. The diggings are some sort of excavation in which he is destined to play an important role. The blue-black fountain pen marks are rivers. 5 of them sprawl from the triple summit of Boondock. 2 of the south-going streams combine to make a larger river. A third stream roughly parallels this one, but the man with the black grease pencil has drawn a stout line across the stream with such force that loose curls of black grease can still be seen dangling from the linen. The fountain pen has been used to scratch out a bulge in the river just upstream of this mark. Apparently they want to dam the river and make a pool or a pond or a lake. It is difficult to get a sense of scale. It is labeled Lake Yamamoto. Looking more closely, he sees that the larger river, the one formed by the confluence of the two tributaries, is also to be dammed, but much farther south. This has been dubbed Tojo River, but there is no Lake Tojo. It appears that this dam will thicken and deepen the Tojo River, but not turn it into an actual lake. Goto Dengo infers from this that the valley of the Tojo River must be steep-sided. The same basic pattern is repeated everywhere on the bedsheet. Grease Pencil wants a complete perimeter security system. Grease Pencil wants one and only one road leading to this place. Grease Pencil wants 2 areas for barracks, one big area and one small area. The details have been worked out by smaller men with better penmanship.
"Worker housing,"
explains Captain Noda, pointing to the big area with his swagger stick.
"Military barracks,"
he says, pointing to the small area. Bending closer, Goto Dengo can see that the larger worker area is to be surrounded by an irregular polygon of barbed wire. Actually, 2 polygons, one nested within the other, a barren space in between. The vertices of this polygon are labeled with the names of weapons: Nambu, Nambu, Model 89 Field Mortar. A road or trail or something leads from there up the bank of the Tojo River, past the dam, and terminates at the site of the proposed diggings. Goto Dengo bends close and peers. The area, including both Lake Yamamoto and the diggings, has been surrounded by a tidy square, neatly crosshatched with Captain Noda's brush and ink, and labeled Special Security Zone. He jerks back as Captain Noda shoves the end of his stick into the narrow space between his nose and the bedsheet and whacks on the special security zone a few times. Concentric ripples speed outwards, like shock waves from dynamite.
"This area is your responsibility, Lieutenant Goto."
He moves the pointer south and taps on the zone farther down the Tojo River, with the worker housing and the barracks.
"This is Lieutenant Maurice,"